Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. In a minute, we'll hear from the psychoanalyst Jameson Webster, who'll explore what we lose when we dull our psychic aches with Prozac and Ambien. And then John Patrick Leary, author of Keywords, Dissects the Language of Contemporary Capitalism. My first guest is Jameson Webster, a psychoanalyst based in New York City. The discipline of psychoanalysis is regarded as quaint or even perverse by many, but I remain a loyal adherent. Webster had a piece in the New York Review of Books website last November that was an extended critique of the use of psychiatric drugs, antidepressants, anxiolytics, sleep aids. By dulling our symptoms, they allow us to ignore what they're telling us about ourselves and our society. When I posted her piece to Facebook, reactions ranged from excited to quite hostile. As you'll hear from the first question, the hostility stemmed from a perception that she and I were indifferent to suffering and elitists for advocating a very expensive form of psychotherapy. Yes, psychoanalysis is very expensive and beyond the reach of most, but Webster's piece and what she has to say in this interview are reminders that time spent listening to Prozac is time not spent listening to what our depression is telling us. Webster's book, Conversion Disorder, Listening to the Body in Psychoanalysis, was published last year by Columbia University Press. In the interview, we talk some about conversion symptoms. These refer to physical symptoms that are of psychological origins, like paralysis of a limb or the loss of one's voice. Many of Freud's early case studies were of such patients. These were also once known as hysterias, but because of that word's misogynistic association, the term has been discarded. Here's Jameson Webster. Whenever you criticize the use of psychotropic drugs, and I've been doing this many times over the years, but not with the sophistication or and length that you go into it, but people react very negatively and say you're being callous and you don't understand how they relieve suffering and that psychoanalysis is a luxury that they can't possibly afford and this is the best compromise. Mm-hmm. Now, I've watched friends who've been on psychotropics for years and I can't say that the outcome has been that inspiring. Mm-hmm. But how do you react to that critique when people say this is, you know, you're being callous and not accepting the way these drugs can reduce suffering?
I've gotten the criticism from colleagues. I've gotten the criticism publicly. I think it's a very contentious issue. But I'd just like to remind people that these drugs are, at best, 30 years old. So, you know,
they're not coming up with new ones all the time.
Well, I mean, they've been coming up with new ones all the time for the last 30 years, but the new ones are usually just variations of the same formula. So it's not really that many new drugs. I mean, there's one drug that spurned all the drugs and they're just, you know, kind of jiggering one or another. And I think that we're in a moment when we're seeing the limitations of them. I think there was, you know, there was a lot of excitement when they came onto the field in the 80s, pretty powerfully, and that all of the hope around what these medications were going to do, I think some of the idealization of that is crumbling. So I, at this moment, sort of wanted to step in and see if we could kind of just take a look at it without the sort of prohibition against saying that this has to be a good, this inevitably has to be a good thing. I think they're very limited. I think there's other ways of treating people. I think that at this point, everyone is seriously over-medicated. I think it shouldn't be a first line of defense. I think we should try a lot of...
You said one in six adults by some estimates or American adults?
Yeah.
That's an enormous number.
It's an enormous number.
According to the OECD, they have some comparative stats on Americans report like the highest lifetime incidence of mental disorders. Of course, Americans also think themselves the healthiest people in the world, according to the same set of statistics. But that sort of thing makes one wonder, is there something about our society that we're overlooking that the drugs are just muffling?
Absolutely. I mean, the part of the reason I wanted to write this article was to talk about the kind of very intertwined relationship between neurosis and civilization. You know, and if we have the kind of bottom line with medication is the idea that there are some people who are sick and who need to be medicated, and then there's the rest of everybody else who's fine. And if everybody's sick, because we have a society that in a certain way is supporting, fostering sickness, then what does it mean to be throwing medication, which at this point looks like it's throwing medication at almost everybody?
Yeah, you know, the prevalence of depression in particular strikes me, because it seems like most young people are depressed to some degree or other. It seems more prevalent than when I was a young person. I don't remember, perhaps we didn't talk about it, perhaps we didn't notice it, but I don't know, there just seem to be so many more depressed people around. And how much of that is because of the availability of antidepressants that increase the diagnostic category, or is, you know, just an increase in alienation and stress driving people into this state?
I think it's both. A psychoanalyst in England that I like a lot, Darian Leader, who's written on various diagnostic categories, shows that their prevalence comes when the drug market is developed. So you create a supply, and then you get a demand for it, in which people have to identify themselves as depressed or as bipolar or as, you know, whatever it would be, ADD. You know, and the incidences then go through the roof. So there is something, there's a strange relationship between the creation of a drug, the creation of a diagnostic category around the drug, and then the blossoming of that. Nevertheless, I do think that we're in a moment in which there's a lot of alienation and there's a lot of anxiety, and this is becoming more and more prevalent, and especially in younger kids.
But melancholia, you know, that's a diagnostic category that goes way back into the early days of psychoanalysis and before, you know, the anatomy of melancholy, what, 16th century or whatever. So is there something different about modern depression?
Yes, because melancholia is something very recognizable to the extent that it affects the body in a way that's completely recognizable, to the extent that the person can't sleep and they can't really wake up. So they're in this like liminal zombie state. And the real melancholic person is very, very ill to that extent. I mean, they literally cannot get out of bed. They can't change their clothes. They can't shower. They can't think. We today call all kinds of things depression. We call being sad depressive. We call being lethargic depressive. We call not really feeling ourselves depressive. We call not really enjoying life depression. So the kind of classical, very extreme melancholia is now a kind of a category that applies to way too many things.
So when people come to see you, is their presenting complaint typically depression?
Yeah, it's some mixture of anxiety and depression.
Freud, you quote this bit from Freud, which is, reminds me of what a Central European hard-ass he was, but like the minute you start asking what the meaning of life is, you're already sick. Yeah. Like, what does that mean?
Basically, Freud was saying that the minute that you have to ask about the meaning of life, the minute that you have to question your existence, you're not in your existence, you're outside of it. And that's essentially to be neurotic, to be caught in the act of reflecting upon something and getting stuck there. And that's neurosis. Neurosis is the movement away from action, drive, desire, into a moment in which you pause it and reflect, but then can't get back from the reflection into life.
But, you know, that would put philosophy out of business, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but Freud said that, he basically said that philosophy was either just obsessive compulsive disorder, or it could be completely paranoiac.
But, you know, he's not unrelated to certain kinds of philosophies, right?
He's not. But I think the therapeutic goal for him in terms of, I don't know, reconciling yourself with your drive and desire life means that, I don't know, something of this kind of obsessive thinking about things can fall away. And we do this more than ever now. I mean, people cannot get out of the narrative loop in their head in which they're trying to figure everything out to no avail.
You know, there's a famous quote from him, what everyone knows, that the goal of psychoanalysis is to transform hysteria into ordinary unhappiness. But it's as if unhappiness should be the baseline human state of some degree, and we just need to get used to it. Is that
right,
the point?
Yeah. Common human unhappiness. Also the capacity to love and work.
Yeah. But we Americans in our founding document believe in the pursuit of happiness, right? Is this just a national obsession that's part of our mass neurosis?
Absolutely. In Civilization and Discontents, Freud has this amazing statement in which he says happiness is just trying to support your illusions with false measurements. The ideal of happiness is essentially to try to hold up all of the illusions that you would like to have about yourself by measuring everything with a false standard. That, to me, seems like a very American problem.
So what are we missing or evading by medicating these feelings away?
I think that we're really missing out on the deep transformations that need to take place in relationship to the very basic structures of the mind. I mean, you have loss, you have attention, you have desire, you have sexuality. I mean, I picked all of the drugs for a certain reason because they represented a portion of the mind. And I said, this is what you're losing in essentially medicating away the problem that this aspect of the mind is posing to you. So you have trouble concentrating. You know, concentration is really, really difficult. How you get yourself to be able to attend to something that you don't like. You know, what anxieties come up. If you take speed in order to just jump over that hurdle, one, you're never going to know what you can do. Two, you're never going to know why you're having difficulty concentrating, which could be really important. And three, I think that whatever you produce is going to be in part based on a medication that's giving you a kind of false megalomaniacal high. So what's the outcome there? So these are the things that I was worried about, not to say that someone doesn't need help sometimes or might need medication for a moment, but if this becomes a blanket way of life, we're going to miss out on a lot.
Well, what is the depression telling us?
The depression is telling us that some old way of life isn't working anymore and that we can't seem to get past it. I mean, Freud, you know, essentially thought that depression meant holding on to something inside of ourselves that we don't want to let go of and that we don't know that we're holding on to. So even that, if you think about it, this act of like clutching something from the inside does not let that energy go out into the world.
Is it some sort of incomplete work of mourning?
Yes. Yeah, that was the idea.
So we're just supposed to let something die and move on.
Right.
I'm speaking with the psychoanalyst Jameson Webster. I often think of the title, and it's been years since I read this, but the title of that essay, Remembering, Repeating, and Working Through. Mm-hmm. It seems like as a culture, we're doing a lot of remembering and repeating, but the working through part seems to be forgotten. Is that your impression?
Yeah, I think we're doing a lot of repeating or enacting of all kinds of things. And I don't see this way in which we're working through to the extent that either we're supposed to be freed from the past in some significant way, or we're also, by virtue of this repetition, supposed to create something new. And politically, it seems very difficult for us to create anything new. We can destroy things. We can kind of try to shore up the old structures, but I don't see a lot that's new popping up on the horizon. And I would say that it has to be about working through.
Yeah, well, collectively, we seem to have lost the possibilities of utopian thought. Yeah. So I don't know, is that a flattening of affect that produces, what is it that?
I think it's a flattening of affect. I think it's probably a lot of alienation and disbelief that doesn't even mount to the pitch of a discontent that would force you into action. It just kind of lives there at a low level. And this is also what makes me think of the drugs, because the drugs kind of take something like that, like let's say discontent or disbelief, right, or depression, and it makes it manageable. It puts it into a manageable package rather than actually letting the agony or the painful feelings or the difficult feelings become intense enough so that you are forced to do something about it.
But when you talk with a patient who's, say, on Prozac or something like that, what does it feel like? Does it feel like you're talking them through a screen or something?
I always use the metaphor that when you listen to someone, you listen to their speech. I mean, part of what we're trained to do as analysts is to really listen to the rhythms of speech and the affective pulls in speech and the anxiety and when it grows a lot or when it goes down. And then you're also listening to the, you know, you're trying to find something in the language of the patient that seems to pop out. When I've worked with people on antidepressants, I feel like I can't do the work. I can't move them somewhere. It's like they're caught between two glass ceilings. They're like in a bell jar, and it's just spinning in neutral. You know, and like week after week, they come back, and I just feel like we're in the same spot. And it's not that we don't talk, and it's not that there's not a connection, and it's not that like little things are done, but something about when you've done other analyses without the medications and you see the qualities of the movement, it's very different.
And what about anxiety drugs?
If anyone's ever taken an anxiety drug, they're great. It's amazing to take it and then feel the anxiety disappear. It feels great. I mean, who would not want this?
Yeah.
The problem is that these are like highly addictive substances. And where do you stop? I mean, their half-life is short. So you take one, it's going to last you half a day at best. You're going to have to take it every day, and you're going to be addicted in a week flat. And they're very hard to come off of.
Well, actually, I had that experience. I was addicted to Valium for a bit. It didn't take very long because I was having trouble sleeping, so I got a Valium prescription. And I was stunned how difficult it was to withdraw from it. It took months, really, to get over those feelings. But they're prescribed with such casual abandon.
I mean, and everyone knows that, like, everyone's trying to get Xanax or Valium or whatever it is for recreational purposes. So I hear about this in the high schools. There's like a, you know, there's like a black market for who can get, you know, their hands on. Like, I treat children, so I hear about all these things. So I just find that terrifying.
And Adderall too.
I mean, yeah, and Adderall. Those are the two that the kids are.
Like, you need one to balance the other.
Right.
And then sleep. You know, I have trouble sleeping. What's happening? What's causing this inability to sleep, and why do we want to medicate it? Well, I know why we want to medicate it away, but what are we missing by medicating it away?
I think that sleep is scary. If we even just think back to being a kid, there was something very scary about letting go of your parents, letting go of the world, and having to drop into some other territory. And I think that this is always with us during our life. And I think in the hardest moments, you know, when there's something going on inside of us, the last thing we want to do is sleep, at the same time that we would like to do is sleep all the time. So sleep is just, it's incredibly important and it's incredibly fraught. And again, you can jump that hurdle by taking an Ambien, but if anyone's taken an Ambien, I mean, it's the strange feeling of being knocked flat. You're not in the sleep, and then all of a sudden you just wake up, and it's as if it's disappeared. You have slept, but you were not there. You are not there in the moment of going to sleep, nor in the moment really of waking up.
And no dreams.
And no dreams.
Why is that important?
I think it's biologically incredibly important. I think it's psychologically incredibly important. I think a lot takes place in the mind during sleep, especially natural sleep. It's like a kind of washing machine. And dreams are invaluable. I mean, I think this is a way to try to figure out what's going on inside of you. And it for me, with patients, it's the, you know, Freud said it's the royal road, and it really is.
The royal road to the unconscious.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not the dreams themselves that is the road, right? It's the when we think about them and talk about them and pick them apart.
Yeah.
That all seems very old-fashioned to a lot of people,
I
right?
Know.
The dreams are actually, you know, we just know they're just meaningless neural firing, and like we don't want to read too much into them. And, you know, this is, of course, the whole critique of psychoanalysis, too. It's just unscientific and literary, perhaps. How do you respond to these criticisms?
I wrote this article and said basically stop taking your drugs and analyze your dreams. I mean, I'm on real hot water here. Or thin ice, or I don't know what it would be. But I really do believe this. This disavowal of meaning, the dreams are nothing, they're neural firing, you know, your problems are chemical, you need the drugs. This I find terrifying. I'd rather sound like a complete idiot than subscribe to, I don't know, a universe like this, I guess.
Hysteria, conversion. We're not supposed to say hysteria anymore, but conversion was what first, you know, attracted Freud's interest. Mm-hmm. And his early works are all about these conversion disorders. It seems that we, although we profess not to be Victorian anymore, we do have a lot of conversion going on now, but a lot of what seem to be psychosomatic illnesses, all these various food sensitivities that people have. What is that telling us?
I mean, it's very, very important, I think, to say, because people get mad when you say conversion disorder, psychosomatic symptoms, because you're saying, like, oh, this is all in your head.
And Freud's, as if that's so insignificant.
Right, as if that's so insignificant. But also, I mean, when Freud started talking about these symptoms, he said they are real. They're real. They're in the body, and they will continue on. And it's not, you know, but they need some psychological component. They need help with some psychological component, but it's very important to say that it's real, because people freak out when it's as if you're accusing them of not really being sick, and I think they're sick. With depression, I mean, it affects you on the level of the body, and this is what was fascinating, psychoanalytically speaking, was that there was this incredible mind-body connection. You know, it wasn't either in your mind or in your body, it was both. Nowadays, I think it's everywhere. Everyone has allergies to food, everyone has problems with their bowels, everyone has undiagnosable mini symptoms related to their heart or to headaches or to just, you know, pain syndromes. It's everywhere at the same time that we've ousted hysteria from the diagnostic and statistics manual.
Now, I read you gave up on gluten yourself.
I tried it.
Oh, you went back.
I went back.
Yeah.
I mean, the wellness industry right now, I think, is a multi-billion dollar industry at this point, but it's there to help people with
these. What is Gwyneth Paltrow treating?
She's treating conversion disorder, and she's making tons of money on it. And I don't think the yoni eggs and the rest of it is what these people need. I think they need someone to talk to. They can do all of that other stuff, too, but they also need someone to talk to.
The early, you know, Victorian conversion disorders were in large part about sexual repression and the frustrations for bourgeois women of living in a patriarchal society. What are the social causes of it today?
I still think it's sexual repression. I still think it's gender war, which is going on. I mean, the Me Too movement is that. I mean, there's a kind of hysterical component to Me Too, which is about we don't know what women and men are supposed to do with one another anymore. We don't know what counts as tenderness or violence. Society at this point tells us that our bodies are supposed to work well and be fit and be beautiful and have great orgasms and all of these things at the same time that we don't have a society that actually supports us being well or feeling well and doesn't take care of our bodies. Not, you know, not just the healthcare system, but the ways in which we live and work are cruel to our bodies. So people are really caught in a contradiction there, of which we're trying to then solve it via more commodities, which I don't think is going to work. I think we need to find a different relationship to our bodies, which is very difficult to do.
When you said that men and women don't know how to relate to each other, did they ever? What is unique about the present?
The violence is more overt. I'm not saying that they ever did, but we had certain structures that are crumbling, whether it was religion or the institution of marriage or certain ways in which society would kind of try to put people together and make it work. And all of this has kind of crumbled in, I guess, the last, 50 years. And I think we're really confused. And while there's been great strides for women in terms of equality, it's making everybody very anxious because, you know, now who's going to take care of the kids or what do we do in the workplace or the questions of power are distributed differently. And I think people are made very anxious by this.
All the anxiety around consent and the rituals around consent where you have to ask. I've talked to a friend who was anxious about flirting because flirting by definition is non-consensual. Well, what's going on there?
It's funny because psychoanalysis started with the question of sexual abuse, right? So Freud was listening to all these patients and they said they were sexually abused. And then he thought, okay, so sexual abuse causes neurosis. And then he thought, well, there's something else here. There's like a fantasy of abuse. There's some people are abused and other people there's...
For which he's roundly condemned now.
Yes, he's radically condemned. But he's condemned because they think that he disavowed sexual abuse. He didn't disavow sexual abuse. He needed the moment of sexual abuse to become something more universal than just a real external experience, to be something in the mind, which is that the mind needs to deal with sexuality, and sexuality inevitably evokes fantasies. Fantasies of violence, fantasies of domination, whatever it would be, that we all kind of have this in ourselves. And it has a lot to do with being a child who's dominated by parents or a child who watches parents dominate one another, right? And that this is inside of us. And I feel like this thing that was really deeply on the inside, let's say at the turn of the century, is now just out in the open. It's out in the open. We don't understand what to do when power and sex mix with one another. And something like consent is this attempt to try to deal with it, which I understand and support to a certain extent. But people don't seem to understand that we have to create new models of being together. And we also have to kind of confront the anxieties of sexuality. Like, I don't think that the anxieties of sexuality can be completely combated with a prescription for a certain kind of consent that one should achieve in order to make sure that they feel okay in a situation.
Well, it sounds like anxiety is to sexuality the way unhappiness is to life as a whole. It's just something you have to deal with, right?
Yeah.
And there's just no way around it.
There's no way around it. But people are really, really upset that they are uncomfortable in their sexuality at this point in time. And they have an ideal of comfortableness that I don't think ever existed, and I think could exist, but I don't know, really. I mean, given as a psychoanalyst, I don't know how comfortable one can ever be with sexuality, because it really is something foreign. But they want it now. They want comfort now. They want to feel less anxious now about sexual relations. And that's a pretty high demand.
I'm speaking with the psychoanalyst Jameson Webster.
In your article, and I've certainly seen this elsewhere many times, that people are having less sex than ever, it seems. Or at least less sex and more recently. What's that about?
I think this desire for comfort and the impossibility of it is making a lot of people give up on sex. And in the younger generation, what I hear from millennials and younger is that they just can't bear the uncertainty, discomfort, bad feelings that come from sexual relationships. They'd rather just hang out with their friends.
Seems like that's giving up an important part of life.
Yeah, it's giving up what's been a huge part of life. I don't judge them for it. I wonder what they'll do with it, with that decision. But I mean, we have to wait and see what this next generation does. But I really profoundly think that they have given up on sex. I mean, even the polyamory, which is like a whole new kind of world, is about never wanting to feel jealous and possessive of your lover. Creating a situation in which you're always with 3-4 different people, it's open, so that you don't get into the trouble that we get into in love, which is to be incredibly jealous and possessive and not know what to do with those feelings. They just want to create a situation where they don't ever have to feel it.
Well, is that a denial of those feelings, or is it, I don't know, an attenuation of feeling? I mean, what's producing that?
You know, it's both. Sometimes it feels like a denial. Sometimes it feels like an attenuation. Sometimes it feels like a displacement. You know, if you've got like a whole situation with 4 or 5 people going on, then you can feel jealous, but then you can kind of move it around. I mean, they're really working hard at trying to deal with these feelings.
But on the other hand, the nuclear family is not known for having produced happiness and health either.
Exactly, but that's
you could put a positive spin on it, saying you're trying to open it up and expand the possibility of human connection. So, but you know, you don't see that happening?
I do. I mean, I think this is a huge response to the failures of the nuclear family. And these are the kids who are the children of the, you know, generation of people who've been divorced. And so I do. I think they want something new. I think they want something else. And again, you know, I as an analyst, I think you try to analyze the situation, and that analysis isn't to judge it. And it's also, I want to wait to see what they do with it.
Do you have patience to talk about these things?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What have you learned from them?
I've learned that there's a deep disappointment with the institutions in society as they've existed. So the institution of family and marriage, there's a real disappointment with it. It just, you know, at this point they say like it doesn't work, and that's more obvious than ever.
And they have a point.
They do have a point. And society-wise, society doesn't take care of you. You know, they don't feel like they're going to get jobs. They don't feel like, you know, they're just, you know, on this healthcare market, you know, trying to put something together that seems ridiculous in order to have their basic needs met. And so they're really turning to community. The community is very important to them, their friend networks. But then because this friend network is so important, they don't want the sex to get in there and mess it all up. So they have elaborate ways of, like, on the one hand, kind of keeping it on the periphery. And deep desires for community. I mean, just deep desires for finding a space that feels safe. And this is what is happening in the universities as well, with all this trigger warnings and all of the rest of it, is that they're obsessed with finding spaces that feel safe. You know, I have nothing but respect for this desire, but I also worry about the fact that they seem less and less tolerant of anxiety and negative feelings.
Yeah, there was this controversy at Yale a few years ago where I went to college, and there's a video taken in the courtyard of one of the residential colleges, and a young woman was screaming at the master. They're no longer called masters of the college, but they were then called masters, that I thought this was a safe space. Mm-hmm. And my memory of Yale was that it was anything but a safe space. It was relentlessly competitive, and you know, everything you said over lunch was judged. So it's somewhat odd to me to see people expect a place like that to be a safe space. Is this, what's producing that?
I think this feeling that the world is violent and unhelpful, and they don't, it's like this idea that they don't want to be exposed to any more of this. That's the whole trigger warning things. Don't show me something that's going to upset me, basically, without at least letting me know and make a decision whether I want to see it or not. Which is wild. It's true. I mean, you went to school to kind of encounter other people and competition and strange things that were upsetting, and they don't want this.
Well, that almost seems like a neurotic symptom.
It does sound like a lot of avoidance, but I mean, what I hear them say, you know, when I challenge patients who, you know, this is part of their world, is that they want to create something somewhere else in a different way. And I really hope they do. I don't know. I mean, this is, you know, as an analyst, I can only hear what they're saying about what they want, and I can kind of analyze the present, and I can try to push them to think about why they're avoiding so many things. Is it really that bad? But what they do is up to them.
Well, it sounds like Marx wrote about alienation long ago, but it sounds like alienation it just pervades everything at this point.
I think that's right. Yeah, I mean, I worry about the more extreme symptoms. I mean, not these kids who have a kind of minimal utopian idea. I worry about the alienation insofar as like the psychotic breaks that men are having that lead them to shoot up schools. That kind of alienation, which I can only see getting worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, I mean, there are some people who just sort of blame that as kind of some kind of fundamental toxic masculinity. What's happening to men, do you think, that's producing these reactions?
I look at a lot of these cases, and it's boys who don't get help. There's no help for them, you know, psychologically or otherwise. With Adam Lanza, who was the, you know, responsible for Sandy Hook, apparently at 5 years old, he went to the Yale Child Study Center and saw a psychoanalyst who in the notes wrote, "This is the most anxious child I've ever seen in my entire career of 30 years at the Yale Child Study Center. Please do not let him live at home with his mother. He needs to be in school. He needs to be socialized. He needs help." And somehow, you know, there was no follow-up. It's sort of devastating to read that and then to think of what happened. I hate the trope, but boys can get into trouble, you know, to a certain extent, and we don't have a world that gives them so many images that are very helpful. And I think there's nothing to catch them at a certain point.
Yeah, I have a 13-year-old son, and watching the pressures of masculinization, you know, which I went through, but they seem more intense now in a lot of ways. Ways you have to perform. And
well, not only do they have to perform, but they also, they also feel sidelined in the world. The critique of privilege and, you know, like their time is up kind of moment. I mean, it's terrible for a boy. You know, on the one hand, you have to perform and be all this. On the other hand, you have to not be that at all. I mean, they're between a rock and a hard place.
And then not feel or express your feelings.
Right.
So is there a way out? Or should we just embrace our failure and unhappiness?
Well, I think if we could embrace our failure and happiness, that might be the beginning of a way out. I mean, I think that what I hear the most with my patients is that they think that they aren't supposed to be failing in the ways that they're failing. And, you know, one of the things that you do very early in treatment is say, how could you not fail given the place that you came from, the things that you've encountered in your life and the world that we live in? You know, so let's start there. Let's like not beat ourselves up for our failures, but let's start with the failure that it almost seems practically inevitable. It's very hard to take that message in because people like blaming themselves and they like feeling guilty in some corner of their mind.
They assume everyone else is thriving and succeeding.
Right, right? Exactly.
But they're not.
They're not, although social media doesn't help people in that respect because everyone puts these images up and everyone thinks everyone else is having a great time. And I guarantee you they're not.
Yeah, because you hear people's dark secrets.
Yeah.
I was Jameson Webster, a New York-based psychoanalyst and author of Conversion Disorder from Columbia University Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of La Triomphante, The Triumphant by François Couperin, performed by Olivier Beaumont. Next, the language of contemporary capitalism. John Patrick Leary is an associate professor of English at Wayne State and author of Keywords, the New Language of Capitalism from Haymarket Books. The book was inspired by the English Marxist Raymond Williams' 1976 book, Keywords, A Vocabulary of Culture and Society, but this is a different book for a different time. John Patrick Leary. So this obviously is a project that has something to do with Raymond Williams' earlier Keywords. What broadly has changed since Williams did that so long ago?
The major difference between my project and his, despite certain stylistic differences, I don't think I could quite manage his kind of Oxfordian erudition. You know, his book is a chronicle of a certain kind of British class society of the 70s. And so a lot of his words that he talks about are kind of, you know, give a history of European modern capitalist civilization or European modernity, I guess you could say. And then some critics of his book have pointed out that he doesn't really talk that much about race and sexuality and the ways in which those are commodified or can be seen as fissures in a, you know, a capitalist system. So, I mean, my book touches a bit on those, but also my book is more about the vocabulary of a certain kind of dominant capitalist imaginary that lives and breathes in our everyday vocabulary as well as in certain kind of oppositional activist kind of cultures. You know, so some of these words like innovation and entrepreneurship and resilience and so forth are words that express a certain sort of opposition to inequality.
You talk some about the use of the word neoliberalism, and sometimes one can be kind of lazy about using that word to describe the present. How useful do you think the label is to describe the world we live in now?
My basic position is it doesn't really matter what word you prefer to use or what you call it, as long as you're describing what I think you should be describing. You know, my attitude about words is not a sort of sacral attitude about the correctness of the term, but about how we use it. So for me, the only discomfort I have with the term neoliberalism is that it tends to overemphasize the newness of the things that we're experiencing as awful impositions of a inflexible, oppressive work regime. So it kind of, to go back to your first question about Raymond Williams, I mean, one way of answering the question, what has changed since 1975 or whenever it was he wrote that book, is to say very little, like nothing has really changed because we're still living in a, you know, a system of globalized capitalism and under a system of wage labor and so forth. And there are certain kind of features of it that are obviously would be unrecognizable to him when he wrote it, technological things and so forth. But I think people sometimes get hung up on the novelty of neoliberalism. And one of the things my book is trying to do is to touch on what feels new and some of what may actually be new, but also to establish the fact that we can be kind of deceived by the technological novelties of our current economy into thinking that we live in some kind of radically new world. And for me, there's a sort of perverse comfort in recognizing that, you know, the sharing economy is sort of like sharecropping, because there's a sense in which, well, people beat sharecropping once before, or people transformed it. And so to think that a particular superstructural maybe feature of the neoliberal economy, this kind of like this way in which we are all turned into entrepreneurs of ourselves and the ways in which we enact that version of ourselves in all kinds of like social media formats or and so forth may feel radically new, but I think it's sort of more historically accurate, but also kind of a bit more encouraging maybe to think about the ways in which we're just living in intensification, you know, the same old system.
You just used a word that is one of your keywords, which is worth exploring, entrepreneur. It was a word that Keynes used in the General Theory, but it did enjoy something of a revival starting in the early 80s. So what is it about that word that is so useful for ideological purposes?
I think it's useful because, to use another one of my keywords, it is empowering, or it appears to be. If you're an entrepreneur, you're not just a businessman or a manager. But entrepreneur instead describes a kind of life purpose or a certain kind of commitment or a certain kind of zeal. You know, it's a word that is often used to describe something that's like what, you know, Max Weber called a vocation in the Frost and Ethic in the Spirit of Capitalism, like a certain kind of like moral commitment. What's useful about it for ideological purposes is that it can frame almost any mundane profit-making enterprise as some kind of life's work. The absurdity of the overuse of the word, I think, often sort of speaks to the ways in which it's becoming hard for people like the kind of writers I chronicle in the book to imagine a life of commitment or purpose that isn't entrepreneurial in some way. And that's there's evidence of that is the proliferation of these kind of absurd entrepreneur portmanteau words, like anybody who does anything is a preneur of some kind. You know, you have pastorpreneurs, you have fempreneurs, people who are sort of feminists in some kind of commercial way, or mompreneurs, tacopreneurs.
Well, you just used another one of your keywords, creative, which is a word that a former Marxist and a former Behind the News guest, Richard Florida, well, I guess he wants to restore his Marxist cred, which is why he wanted to be on my show. But he did inject that into discourse, that use of creative. What about that?
Creative is a difficult one because in certain ways it's like innovation in the sense that I think it captures a lot of what is dominant about the contemporary ideology of, if you like, neoliberalism. In a way, so like entrepreneur, it is a concept that frames our labors in the world economy as acts of creation or acts of self-fulfillment and as acts of individual achievement. You know, a purpose that is other than the sort of vulgar pursuit of profit. Creative, though, is also interesting because it has a word that Raymond Williams, one of the few in the book, maybe the only one in the book that Raymond Williams also talked about. And the thing that he points out is that creative has this split in the late 19th century where the word creativity comes from. You know, the word creativity is a kind of recent coinage. That's because of this first split in the history of the word, which is that creation becomes a secular kind of concept, something that people can do. So because before that, the only being who can create is God, who creates the world. And then creation becomes something identified with human productivity in the late 19th century. And then there's this other split between productive work and artistic creativity, which becomes coded as solitary and kind of masculine and tormented and tortured and so forth. You know, you're like scribbling away in your artist studio, tormented by your visions or whatever. But then people who are fashioning meals in a kitchen or who are building a thing, like building a chair or harvesting a crop, you know, we don't think of those people as creative. And that's like an important split in the history of the word. And I think the way that's relevant for people now is that when capitalists or, you know, people who run a company or people who are kind of in a managerial role at a company are called creative, and when any kind of work usually in an American city is like to refer to the Florida usage is understood as creative, it imbues it with some of the romance of the artist, and it also imbues it with that myth of the solitary artistic work, you know, as if it doesn't rely on other people and as if it doesn't rely on in networks of people to support you. And that's kind of a major myth of the manager in the U.S. economy, especially after the 60s, this idea of the self-fulfilled, self-driven, self-made, committed corporate leader.
Yeah, well, the heroic entrepreneur is supposed to replace the, you know, the man in the gray flannel suit.
Yeah, right, exactly.
A couple of words seem very core to the way we're supposed to view ourselves in this neoliberal era. The brand, you're your own brand. Human capital, we're not workers, but we invest in we don't educate ourselves, we invest in our human capital. Talk some about this ideology of the function of how we all relate to the larger system.
You mentioned brand. One of the subcategory words in the book that I talk about is what I call body talk. Words like lean, nimble, the brand, robust, that are words that either metaphorically or at least initially in their history refer to bodies. One of the major points that they all have in common, and brand is a good example of this, is that a lot of these words imagine firms, corporations, businesses, or whatever as bodies, except as masses of actual human bodies that work and are tired and need to sleep. So, you know, when you talk about a layoffs at a company, making it more nimble or lean, you're very deliberately obscuring, evading, kind of euphemizing away the people that will pay the price for that. And brand is a word that actually perversely allows us to imagine ourselves as commodities, but to do so in a way that's ostensibly serving ourselves. You know, when you brand yourself, One of the bizarre things about this usage is that that's not seen as something humiliating or debasing. It's seen as something that is liberating and sets us free somehow.
I'm speaking with John Patrick Leary, author of Keywords, The New Language of Capitalism from Haymarket Books. A lot of these words that you write about do originate either from, you know, the business press or business pundits, management consultants, people like that. But here's a word that originated, I guess you could say, from a critical wing of the bourgeoisie or a self-critical wing of the bourgeoisie, sustainable and sustainability. What has that taken on?
Well, so sustainable is one of the words that, like empowerment and resilience in my book, that, as you say, emerge from a certain critical lineage. And sustainability is a word that we know refers to, you know, ecology or the environment in some way. So a business that has some kind of environmental consciousness wants to make products sustainably. And as I talk about, the word is particularly popular and particularly useful because it's so vague. It's so functionally vague. And that's a characteristic that a lot of the words I talk about have in common. It's not a sort of absolute term. You can't be You're not sustainable or not sustainable. You're more sustainable than something else. So as I say in the book, you know, a tire fire is more sustainable than a nuclear explosion. You know what I mean? But it doesn't make a tire fire an ecologically sound event. So it's a word that allows the people who use it to kind of mask actually ecologically destructive practices as being sustainable, because, I mean, you can always be less sustainable, right? And it's a word whose history kind of comes out of the 70s and a critique of economic growth and a growing understanding, even among business leaders and politicians in Western Europe and North America, that continuous economic growth would have a kind of destructive effect on the environment. And so sustainability becomes this way of imagining a capitalist growth model that could be sustained over the long term. And that's the other meaning that sustainable has, something we can keep doing. And I think that's ultimately the kind of ideological effect of it. It lures us into a sense that we can keep doing what we're doing. We can sustain our current practices in a way that is sustainable.
In closing, let's step back a bit. And what did this exercise of writing the book teach you about how capitalism today or its ideologues want us to think about it as a system?
I guess I would say to not think about it as a system is basically the point. And again, that's an old story too. And that's, I think, a point I want to underscore over and over again, is that, you know, there's nothing really that new about the new language of capitalism, despite the subtitle on the cover of my book. But the particular ways in which we are encouraged not to understand the system in which we live as a system, in other words, as something that is orchestrated and organized for the profit of some at the expense of others, is through the circulation of this language of privacy, by which I mean, like, not just the private economy or private property, but almost kind of all kinds of private, that is to say, individual feelings, practices, behaviors are reimagined as forms of generating value. You know, so passion is a word that used to belong totally outside of the economy. It was something forbidden and something kind of uncontrollable. And now everybody fresh out of college is encouraged to pursue their passion through selling their labor to somebody else. And there's this kind of fantasy that is perpetrated by a lot of wealthy people that is in fact possible to do for the majority of people, that, and, you know, your day job will satisfy your kind of deepest passions and your most earnestly held convictions. And innovation, another word that describes a kind of individual human capacity. It's something we like to think of like creativity that we're born with. And the thing that disturbs me the most about the words that I wrote about is the ways in which these kinds of ostensibly innate human capacities that come from far outside of the contemporary business world or market economy are understood not just to be useful to succeed in that economy, but actually, like, they have no function other than through the private economy. And so that leads people into this perverse situation where they enroll their toddlers in entrepreneurial daycare centers, which is a thing.
Oh God, I hadn't heard that. That's grotesque. And last question, did doing this change the way you speak and write?
Yeah, I mean, I never say innovate anymore unless, or innovation, unless I'm writing about it critically. which can be hard to do because there are not a lot of good words to describe that kind of practice of bringing something new or into the world or developing some new method of doing something. So it's forced me to be particularly self-aware of when I'm speaking and writing. And it's hard because the contemporary language of capitalism has colonized so many everyday activities as sort of sources of business wisdom or as ways of getting ahead. You know, it's very hard to talk about being passionate about anything without me thinking and hearing Steve Jobs kind of whispering in my ear.
But it forces you to be more creative.
Yeah, but there you go.
I know. There's no way out. That's what makes it a system, right?
Exactly.
That was John Patrick Leary, author of Keywords, The New Language of Capitalism from Haymarket Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. We had some Cooper on earlier in the show and also in each of the last 2 weeks because I've been imagining life as a bewigged aristocrat. So let's go out with this, the Rigaudoon from Ravel's Le Tombeau de Couperin, which literally means his tomb but figuratively means a memorial, performed by Bertrand Chamailloux. Till next week, bye.